Holy shit, look over there. It's Doug Kent Crispin. Welcome to the Sprocket Podcast, where we are simplifying the good life. My name is Brock Dittus, and this is Vincent Caldoni sitting in for Brandon Rhodes. And he's reading copy that I handed him 2 seconds ago.
We are broadcasting the People's Republic of Portland, nestled in the heart of Cascadia. We're the show that brings you somewhat irrelevant conversations about the intricacies of thinking locally with a global perspective and enjoying the best that life has to offer along the way.
Yes, I like that. Somewhat irrelevant conversations. somewhat irreverent conversations is actually what we have, but that's okay. I think it works.
I was still fixated on your bike riding music. It just feels like riding a bike on a spring day.
Thank you. Thank you so much. We're covering day-to-day life, food, alcohol, Oregon history, bicycles, transit, living outdoors, going camping, and many, many other things. Also in the room with us is resident historian of orhistory.com. That's Oregon history. Well, the website is orhistory.com, but it's known as Oregon history, I believe. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Mr. Doug Kent Crispin.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm very pleased to be here this evening.
Thanks for joining us.
You bet. It's nice to be on the other side of the microphone. Well, it's actually the same side, but you know what I mean.
Right. The live side as opposed to the well-produced side.
Thank you.
So we are here in the room. We're in the Sprocket Podcast Studios here in Lentz, Portland, Oregon, United States, Earth. And we've got plenty of stuff on the docket. We're going to talk about Oregon history because Doug was kind enough to allow me behind the soundboard of the event on April 20th, I believe.
March 20th.
March 20th.
Humanity on Wheels.
I make this mistake many times.
That's fine.
April 20th was Dr. Jeff's wedding, if I remember correctly.
Oh, wonderful.
So I think I have those two dates transposed.
Yeah. Which is the mark of a true Cascadian because April and March in most places in the world are totally different. But here they're all but the same.
That's right. Yeah. Well, I mean, one is slightly less soggy than the other. Yeah. But 420 was a great date for a wedding as well.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So, anyways, March 20th is when it was the Humanity on Wheels, which
was down at the Jack London Bar.
Yeah. Yeah.
TrimentDiaries.com kind of hosted that, right. And we assisted with that. So that was just a fantastic celebration of all things mass transit.
It really was. And the most recent episode of Oregon History, Kick-Ass Oregon History is the podcast, actually, featured, I believe, the entire event, uncut.
The entirety. Yeah, yeah.
2 hours.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was a long one, and I have a prize for anyone's listened to the entire thing.
Okay, there you go. Well, maybe if it's any consolation, I've listened to the entire thing, but not that recording. Because I'm actually going to be cutting up the recordings that I made from behind the soundboard for some summer episodes when I'm away on tour. So anyways, that's how Doug and I first bumped into each other.
That's
and
right.
That was when we said, hey, we should do a podcast together.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So yeah. Here we are.
Here we are. Let's hope it's good.
Yeah.
And not 2.5 hours long.
Well, if it's 2.5 hours long, it has to be terribly, dreadfully entertaining. We really hope for that to be the case. And Caldoni, you're here because you've been here before, and we talked about Oregon history, and it went fantastically. So Brandon was initially hoping to have you in just kind of as a, you know, like a filling in the gap sort of guy, and for the two of you to bullshit together as you are, I think, both very well capable of doing.
Yeah.
So anyways, Brandon had a school thing. He's not here.
Right.
And we miss him. We wish him well. I tried calling him. I was going to try and get his voice on the show somehow tonight, but he's up drinking, I think, and smoking cigars and talking theology with his classmates. So I can't imagine a greater weekend.
Yeah, it could be a lot worse.
Yeah, exactly.
Blue cigars and God, it doesn't.
No kidding. No kidding. Yeah, so there you go. And
is God a Macanudo kind of guy?
I'm sure he probably is. Yeah.
He smokes Dominican.
So here we are. I heard through the emails, Doug, that you went camping this weekend.
I did. I actually shat in the woods this morning. And I don't know about you guys, but when I shit in the woods, I just get this, like, it's going to be a good fucking day, no matter what. I mean, you know, you're sitting there, you're deep in the woods. You're deep enough that modesty isn't a concern. Mm-hmm. There's that cool breeze in your face, the smell of the earth, the cool breeze on your ass. And it just doesn't get better than that.
Yeah. Yeah,
and it has been a wonderful day.
That's fantastic. Very well. So which woods did you shit in, sir?
We're up north of Goldendale in Washington, the lesser cool state to the north, but still pretty damn cool nonetheless. Yeah, we're up there camping.
So if you're in the woods in Goldendale, watch your step.
Yeah, exactly. We take my buddies and I, we've gone up for the past 6 years. We bring our kids up and we teach them kind of Stone Age man stuff.
There you go.
Yeah. It's cool. It's what we like doing on Memorial Day.
That's fantastic. So when society falls apart, as it inevitably will, that your kids are going to be educated. They will know how to make fire.
They will know how to make a fire. Exactly. I will be crying for Twitter and they will make me some fires.
And they'll be like, tweet this.
Exactly.
But that's fantastic. Goldendale is it's not quite the desert, but it starts to get a little bit more more piney and not quite as fur-y, I guess.
Yeah. It's beautiful in its own way.
Right. So. And just north of Goldendale is the Yakima Indian Reservation.
That was a little bit further than we were, but it's further up there.
So, I made that drive several years ago, back when I had a car, and I was driving through. I cannot remember the name of the town. I'm the name Tenasket comes to mind, but that's another Eastern Washingtonian town that's nowhere near what I'm thinking of. Mm-hmm. But there were mint fields, and I was driving, you could smell the mint wafting on the air, and that was fantastic. So I always wanted to take a bicycle tour through there someday, just to spend more time in the presence of live growing mint.
I highly recommend shitting in the morning in that area. outside.
Fantastic. Mr. Caldoni, what did you spend your Memorial Day weekend doing?
My family has a plot of land on Mount Hood it's been in our family since the early 1900s, and we got an old 1909 house up there, and I spent my weekend up there playing in the river, doing some fishing. Wait. You should probably cut that. I don't think I was legally fishing.
Okay. Well, someone like you, but legally distinct.
Another
from
person
you,
may have put a line in the river, but
if you caught nothing, is it fishing?
That's a good point. But yeah, we did a little of that, and we had a fire. We did some outdoor grilling and some hiking, and had a good weekend.
There you go. Well, fantastic. Yeah. And I think this might be the cabin that you and Brandon went up to and drank copious amounts of whiskey at.
And as we did this weekend, except for there was no Brandon, which was sorely missed.
It happens.
But yeah, I think it's pretty much an established fact going back to the cabin's construction that, one, you call it a cabin, though it is bigger than most houses, and two, you drink a lot of whiskey when you were there.
There we go.
I don't think it's ever not been that way since it was constructed.
Right. Are you, you have a gluten intolerance, correct?
Yeah.
So does whiskey work for that? Is it processed to the point where it doesn't bother you?
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, the distillation process kills all the gluten in whiskey, even though it comes from wheat.
I'll keep that in mind for my 8-year-old son who's gluten issues.
It's a common misconception that whiskey constitutes a gluten product, but nope, you can drink whiskey and scotch and rye.
Right, and that's because it's been distilled like the Dickens. It's been put through many different things.
Exactly.
The gluten is far, far removed from the product that you're drinking.
Boiled out in the initial process, yeah.
There you go. Well, that's good to know. Yeah, I drank a lot of whiskey this weekend. I was planning, I believe, at the Humanity on Wheels event, there was a special drink called the Mad Max.
It was the Mad Max.
Yes.
Right. And Jim Crow and PBR. Right?
Yeah, Old Crow.
Old Crow and Jim Crow. Jesus.
I was going to say.
That's a different kind of drink altogether.
It's tasty.
We did meet some of those folks out on the road. But,
tasty hate.
But no, the... I was just drinking whiskey, and I was thinking, I should bring this home for the podcast so we can make this Mad Max drink. And then I realized I really like whiskey, and so I just kept on drinking it. And you know, before you know it, over a long 3-day weekend, there's just not enough whiskey to last until Monday night. So
yeah. Oh yeah, we had that issue. What happened to the Tomor Dew?
Yeah.
Apparently we drank it all. How did we do this?
So the question I have for you, Doug, is what did the Mad Max taste like? Did you have one the night of?
I was so fucking sick that night.
Okay.
Like, I had been sick for days ahead of time, and I have never canceled a show. And I was so glad about it, and I was so close. And I no, I cannot. So I was drinking, but I have no recollection of what anything tasted like. Oh,
so, not a good night for the taste buds.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, I'm curious. It's just one of those, is a Boilermaker? Is that the technical name for?
Yeah, I think this one was a shot, though, with a PBR back.
Okay.
I don't know that God forbid if I drank something that was mixed like that. You know, I don't recall.
All right, here's a question. A Boilermaker, is that when they actually drop the shot into the PBR? Or into the beer, or is it when you get them both together and you can drink them however you please?
That's a good question.
Because I wonder, because I see guys, they get a Boilermaker and then they literally take the whole glass, they sip a little off the beer, and then they drop it in.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
And then they drink it.
Right.
And is that make it a Boilermaker, or if you have a full pint as a back and a whiskey and a shot, is that a Boilermaker?
Yeah, that was my question. Is it a generic term or is it a very specific drink?
Yeah,
I do not know.
Yeah.
Well, three.
I feel better than I don't.
Fuck, you know. Next time I suggest you have an expert on the show.
Yeah, definitely not.
Yeah, next time I'm in the bar with a bunch of trade unionists, I'll feel less bad about asking.
I was going to say, we have several. One of our new segments is Brock and Brandon Watch YouTube, in which, you know, we sit here and watch video, which those of you listening cannot actually see, and we comment on the video, which is great fun. So this is a new segment called Three Idiots Talk About Mixed Drinks. And now we know.
Couldn't we expand the segment to just things we don't know about?
Three Idiots Talk Shit.
Hey, Brock, what's the difference between a slug and a snail?
One has a carapace, right? Some sort of covering on its upper side.
You ruined my whole friggin' gag. I don't know.
We saw slugs. I didn't see any snails at all. So I went camping this weekend as well. I went to Cape Lookout.
Nice.
This was the reunion of Team Sincerity, which was the team of people that rowed to Crater Lake.
Mm.
Yeah. Sorry, it's been so long, it's not quite coming back to me. But anyway, some of us that were on this trip this weekend also went to Crater Lake last summer. Mm-hmm. And Team Sincerity, it was basically just we're kind of sarcastic people, but we also have this streak of just like getting really excited about things that we really do genuinely love. And so Team Sincerity was all about riding bikes and pumping your fist in the air and yelling best day ever at people who might not actually have been having the same experience. So anyways, Team Sincerity crested the coastal range from Forest Grove and Hillsboro at the end of the Blue Line Max out to Forest Grove. Forest Grove. What's the name of that town? Tillamook, where they make the cheese.
Yeah.
Anyways, we rode all the way out there, and we went camping at Cape Lookout State Park, which has the most fantastic hiker-biker campsite of almost any place, I think, in the world, perhaps. It's like camping in Rivendell. You've got all these trees growing up. You're right on the ocean. I guess that's not quite like Rivendell. But anyways, it's an elven forest.
It sounds kind of better than Rivendell.
Yes, it is, actually, because it's real. And it's removed from the car camping areas. The car camping, you know, car camping is generally just a parking lot with some trees thrown in. And this campground that we were in was removed from the actual camping loops.
Yeah.
So you've got a sense of peace and quiet. You've got the ocean making its gentle murmur in your ear as you go to sleep at night. And it's really fantastic, and it's accessible by Portland from Portland by bus. The wave, the Tillamook wave, goes out to Tillamook, and then you can take another bus within 6 miles, I think, of the place. So it would be a stout walk, but you could do it.
Nice.
And it's also accessible by bicycle if you, as we did, go to Hillsboro by Max and then just ride over the coastal range. It's about 70 miles. It's a long ride, but if you train up and get ready for it, you can do it. So comes on my high recommendation.
To follow up on our last podcast, I did find out that daily the CC Rider will take you into Columbia County.
That's right.
From there, you can take the Lewis and Clark Express into Astoria, connect with the Wave, and do a full loop all the way down to Tillamook and back into Portland.
So in one day, you could ride a bus all the way around, basically the Manila folder tab of Oregon, as I like to call it.
Of North Oregon. You could do the entire North Shore, Columbia River from Portland out, and around through the Tillamook area.
Nice. You could sleep at your own house that night.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And it would cost you under $15.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That's the great thing about connecting transit lines. Doug, have you looked into any of this?
You know, I've followed some, you know, the folks that have posted some of the things on there. But no, I haven't actually taken them myself.
I have here in my hands, this is a gift from a Sprocket Podcast listener who I met in Olympia. And it's called Bus Fare by Dan Leahy. I think that's how you say his name. But it's just an essay of a trip he took in 2008 from Olympia, Washington to Los Angeles, California, almost all using public transit lines.
That is awesome.
This is a fantastic essay. I haven't figured out how to get in touch with Leahy. He's, I believe he is a retired professor who used to be at the Evergreen College in Olympia. And so if I can get in touch with him and find out if it's okay to distribute this, I'm going to put it up on the internet for people to read and look at because it's fantastic.
So that's pretty cool.
Anyways, it's here, and all of you listening can't have it yet. There's that.
Yeah.
So maybe we should do some news. Just a couple of things, and then we'll jump into talking about Oregon history and bicycles.
Excellent.
All right. Here's our news headlines theme.
What can compare with the thrill of a brand new bike?
I like my bike, it's fast. I like my bike, it's fast. I like my bike, it's fast. It circles around the city lights.
Pedal just as fast as we can into the morning light. Pedal just as fast as we can into the daylight. Pedal just as fast as we can into the night light. Pedal just as fast as the leg of the ladder. Your pedal just as fast.
So first up, we've got from Rowdy Kittens, and actually I just learned that Tammy and Logan of rowdykittens.com, it's a website about simplicity and living in a tiny house, they are actually moving away from Portland. They've been here for a long time, but family things happening down in California are drawing them that direction, so we're going to miss them, but the good news is the podcast is available everywhere, and Logan, who's been listening for a while, will still tune in, I'm sure, and comment from time to time. They went bike camping with Russ and Laura from the Path Less Pedaled, and they went to Stubbs Stewart State Park out just south of Vernonia. Have you guys seen this place? Have you? Are you familiar?
I filmed up there.
You have?
Yeah.
What have you filmed there?
We shot the horse riding segment of the Macmillan Girl forthcoming Oregon history mockumentary. Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, it's coming out. It's been a long time in the making. It's a passion project of mine. But yeah, we filmed out there.
Oh, that's cool.
Really incredible place.
And one of the featured attractions of Stubbs Stewart State Park is that it has plenty of equestrian trails.
Yeah, oh, for sure.
Some of which are also pedestrian trails, which you can go out and just hike around in. And mm-hmm. It's one of my favorite bike camping destinations. It's a second runner-up for most like Rivendell, I think, of trees growing and a place to go camping with your bike. But it's really beautiful, and it's also accessible from the end of the Blue Line. It's out there in western Washington County, I guess. Washington County in Oregon.
In Oregon, yeah.
But the western part of that county.
Is it really? Is that true?
I think maybe it's in Columbia, because the Columbia County Rider goes there.
It's like it's right on the line of where those two kind of zigzag up by Vernonia.
That's right. Transit reference for the win.
But yeah, the cool thing about the camp is that if you get in there, whether you do it by a bus or car or Blue Line or whatever, you get out there.
Or horse.
Unlike, say, a national park, is that they have the camp heads, mm-hmm. the camp chiefs, I think they call them, who are just citizens. They don't even make any money for doing it, who live in RVs year-round out there.
Oh, right, like the hosts.
Yeah, yeah. And they're there mostly they're there for the horse people.
Okay.
But if you're a hiker or a biker or just there for the day, you can go knock on – you're literally allowed to go knock on their door and say, what's up today? Like, where's a good place to go? And those people are like over the moon when you go in there and you're like, I'm here to film a movie illegally. What should I do? And they're like, wow, someone wants to talk to me. And they're like a wealth of information about every inch of that park.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, they're really great. It makes the park so much more fun that you have instant access to somebody who knows it like the back of their hand.
Yeah, it's almost like an art museum docent or something like that, except they're probably less stuffy and more friendly.
Yeah, way more. Yeah,
they chop a lot more wood than in the museum. Yeah,
It's true. I've been looking for a good way to kind of encapsulate my experience at Stubbs Stewart Park for a long time, and this news article, the two fun words, bike camping. It's just a fantastic article. There's actually a video attached, which I have not yet read, but there are also some great pictures here. And this, if you guys can see that,
Those are beautiful.
Yeah. This is the beautifully treed wooded area. Mm-hmm. And there are communal fire rings at this. It's not technically a hiker biker site. It's a walk-in campground, which means you could park your car there and walk in and camp. Mm-hmm. It also means that you're not guaranteed a space if you show up and it's full. Mm-hmm. The hiker biker thing works out like basically they understand that you're a slow moving sort of person and you're not going to be able to like just drive down to the next motel. You may not even be able to afford that. And so they work with you and try and get you in there as best they can. Stub Stewart apparently has been getting full, and I'm trying to remember somewhere on the Twitter, I think someone was talking about showing up and wanted to bike camp and it kind of being full. But it's also nice weather in Portland for the first time you know, 8-12 months or whatever.
And that's the site you can take the paved trail into?
It's actually unpaved. I believe it's something like a half mile's walk from the main parking lot. And it's a gravel path that kind of goes through the woods. You can park there, or there's the back way, which I've gone once by bike and never again will do. It's one of the equestrian trails. I think it goes through the woods. It's beautiful, but the incline is something like 20%. It's like a really, really steep, and it might be an old logging road or something like that.
I know that. I think it's where we filmed.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Nice.
It goes way up and it drops way down and then you come out.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like a big circle.
I think, sounds about right. A lot of that used to be logging material. People would go out and cut down trees and sell them, and that was how they made their money. And it's a big part of Oregon's history. It's also something that's kind of, at that point, I guess, no longer viable. Like, there's far less logging happening than there used to be. So, anyways, the old roads have been repurposed into horse trails, bike trails, all kinds of stuff. So if you're interested at all in camping out at Stub Stewart State Park, check out that article. So that's number one. Number two. Oh, yes, and please.
Oh, yes, as you say, there's also a campsite that is handicap accessible there.
Oh, really?
That's the one I was thinking of.
They
have a big stretch of, I think it's 5 miles of paved trail.
Okay.
I may have that number wrong. But they do have a site that is a non-drive-in site that's off of a paved trail that is handicap accessible. You could literally run a wheelchair right out to the site.
That's really nice to know. That's
really cool.
Yeah, definitely. And there's a lot of people if you're handicapped in that regard, it's probably difficult to find camping that really works.
There's so few.
Yeah, for sure.
That's not car camping.
Right, right. Well, that's great. I'm going to have to look into that. That's nice to know about.
Yeah.
All right. There we go. Next story. sorry. This is the wrong story. That's something for later. Bicycling Magazine has once again assigned Portland the honor of number one bicycling city in America.
I'm shocked.
Yeah, exactly, right? It's have you guys...
holy shit, I would have been pissed if we lost to Cincinnati or something.
Well, the thing is, last year we lost to Minneapolis, Minnesota, and it was it was a big coup. You know, it was like...
I've been to Minneapolis. I can't see it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well,
and I like Minneapolis.
Part of the reason you can't see it in Minneapolis is that Minneapolis has done a fantastic job of constructing off-road paths for bicycles. Mm-hmm. So instead of bicycle lanes and combined infrastructure, I believe Minneapolis has actually done more of the off-road paths, kind of like the Springwater Corridor that we have here. It's like one of two bicycle paths in Portland.
So it's unseen. It's separate but equal kind of thing. Right?
Yes. We have separate sidewalks and that sort of thing. Yeah, so I think maybe part of the reason that Portland reclaimed the title is that it's so visible here. You come to Portland, you will see bicycles everywhere, whether you like it or not.
I do that. I do the bus commute over the Hawthorne Bridge every day.
Right.
And it's like, it's amazing how many bikers you see have to cross that bridge.
Definitely.
And what an important part of traffic they are and how co-equal they are to the bus, to the cars.
Yeah, definitely. So people are really happy about this whole about reclaiming the title, and it's kind of arbitrary. It's kind of silly in some ways, and maybe in a lot of ways. But whether like it or not, it matters. It's one of these big cultural pieces, and a lot of people are really excited about it. I was thinking about the Hawthorne Bridge. They're actually getting a bicycle counter installed. They have these in a lot of European cities, I understand. It's basically just telling you how many people have crossed the bridge that day, or how many bicycles have passed the sensor. So they'll keep account for, I think, bicyclists today, and then bicyclists either this month or year, something like that. So you have a running cumulative total that you can look at and say, hey, check out what a great bicycling city we are. So I'll be interested to see how the numbers go on that. But that'll be the first time I think any American city has tracked in real time bicycling bicycling data, because I think I've seen people around town just on one weekend a year where you'll have volunteers with a clicker in their hand and a clipboard, and they're just standing at an intersection and watching bicycles travel past. One day out of the year doesn't give you a full picture of that. And we have, you know, for automotive transit, we have all kinds of metrics and data that we've collected to figure out how traffic patterns work, to the point where Google now can tell you like what's happening with your commute as you're driving.
Yeah.
So if there was something like that for the Hawthorne Bridge, like if I could figure out how to get down to the Hawthorne Bridge at a time when I knew I wasn't going to be run into the path of an oncoming bus by an over-enthusiastic person training for a ride that they may not actually participate in, I would like that.
Yeah, it's at once amazing and terrifying when you see right at the head of the bridge that traffic jam that comes every day. Mm-hmm. And it's like you've got all these cyclists and they're all in that green bike lane, and then I'm on the 4 bus and that bus has to cut into that lane, mm-hmm, to get that last stop before you hit the bridge. And every time it's some kind of drama where, like, you know, bus is getting over and bikers are getting out of the way, and you're like, somebody's going to wind up between, yeah, the bus and that curb at some point.
Yeah,
it's so great that, you know, that we have that much transit that it's like a traffic jam. Mm-hmm.
The fact that it works, I'm very impressed with that. And especially with notable deaths in the news, you know, over many years, but especially in the past couple of weeks, there have been some real tragedies that have happened. And so the fact that we do have this much bicycle traffic and that it does play nicely with transit and with traffic by and large is pretty encouraging. So, mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm. Which line? That's the 14 line. Or no, it's the 4 that you're
four
on.
4 I ride in. Yeah.
And is that eastbound or westbound?
It'd be westbound in the morning.
Okay, so you're heading downtown. That's right, yeah. And so there's a bike box that you say, there's a merge there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, at that last stop before you go onto the
bridge. Oh, right at Grand.
There's a big stretch of green at that bike box. And there's a stop, there's a bus stop that fits right in the middle of that. So there's no trade-off. It's like the bus has to cross the white line, go into the green, and pull up to the stop.
Right.
And it's like there's a, you know, at 8 in the morning, there's a bunch of people in that box.
Right.
And there's just no real, that I know of, protocol for how that bus gets in and how the people in the box deal with the bus as it comes in. But it's also because it's crossing out of traffic. It's not like they can just slam on the brakes,
mm-hmm, right,
and wait for everybody to go by and hit a, mm-hmm, brake and come in. It's a ballet. It's a careful ballet.
Yeah. it's just a dexterous dance.
But it always works.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
you know, the cool thing is that, like, it seems a little messed up, mm-hmm, but it always in the end works, and it doesn't slow the bus down terribly bad, and it doesn't seem to retard the commute of the bikers.
That's cool to see. Yeah, yeah. That's fantastic. Maybe it's worth mentioning that Pedalpalooza is only a couple weeks away. And Pedalpalooza, of course, is the 3-week celebration of bicycling, completely crowdsourced and without any official administration. I mean, there are people who say this is happening. Shifttobikes.org is where the calendar for all the events are. But basically, people lead their own events. If you like a certain thing and you want to combine it with bicycles, you do that. So the one that I enjoyed last year was the Bowie versus Prince dance party. There were several mobile sound systems on cargo bikes, on regular bikes, on trailers, and there were probably,
that's awesome,
I don't remember how many folks. I feel like it was upwards of 200 people on bikes, all dancing. You know, we rolled into the 7-Eleven on Hawthorne and like 40 something, and we hung out in their parking lot there, boosted their sales dramatically that hour of alcohol. Everyone came out, open container in the parking lot, and there was much dancing to be had. So anyways, things like that. And of course, the World Naked Bike Ride, which happens every year, and it just keeps on getting bigger and bigger. So keep your eyes open for all that stuff. It's shift2bikes.org. So yeah, anyways, that's the end of our news.
You're taking a lot of responsibility in owning and riding a bicycle. You are now an operator of a wheeled vehicle.
All right. Well, Doug Ken Crispin, thank you again for joining us. Thank you for coming in.
Absolutely.
We're going to talk about Oregon history.
That sounds great. There's nothing I love talking about more than kick-ass Oregon history.
That's right. And we hope that you all agree that this episode of the Sprocket Podcast features some kick-ass Oregon history.
I certainly hope so, too.
Is it okay if I borrow that?
Please do.
That's the trademark line. I think that's what you close every show with.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Andy Lindberg, my co-host, closes with that.
So. Which, he has a fantastic radio voice.
He does. He has a fantastic Oregon cinematic history as well. Mm-hmm. Quite kick-ass. I don't know if our listeners are aware of it, but Andy Lindberg Greenberg is a Portland native. He lives in New York City now. He's the voice of Kick-Ass Oregon History. And he was originally in a film that most people have seen, which is called Stand By Me.
Oh, is that right?
And he's a character that most people remember. His name was Lard-Ass Hogan, the one who vomited on everybody in the pie eating contest.
Yeah, I remember this.
So
I was thinking about this just the other day.
Yeah, Lard-Ass is the voice of Kick-Ass Oregon History.
No, oh, my God. That's fantastic.
Absolutely.
That's good to know.
I talked about Macmillan, which is a Oregon history themed film that we did. He was actually in touch with the producer of that film.
There we go. Excellent. Cool. Excellent. Yeah, nice. Definitely. So we wish he were here this evening, but of course he's in New York City.
It's kind of impractical, I guess, just being on different sides of the country.
Definitely. But again, it's the joy of podcasting. We can do this, again, through iTunes and a lot of other things. And, you know, we work in GarageBand and we send clips back and forth. And it works out wonderfully.
Yeah. It's kind of like that band, The Postal Service, which got their name from mailing records back and forth to each other until they finally had a complete album that featured the songs they had written collaboratively in that way. So the internet has made that way easier to do.
And it's cut your postage down quite a bit.
Definitely, yeah. Matter of fact, we may not have Saturday delivery soon. But so, you know, we didn't actually talk about this before we started the recording, so we're going to jump in with both feet, and we're going to figure out what happens. But I see you have a stack of papers in your hand there. You have a sheaf of knowledge that you brought.
Yeah, we've been kind of looking at some of the things. I know that we kind of swung around some ideas a little earlier in the week on the web, and then a good historian friend of mine is Finn John,
who's
down, he teaches down in Corvallis, and he's been working on a book called Wicked Portland.
Nice.
Which features a lot of the really bad shit that happened in Portland in the 1880s and 90s. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the characters that are in there, you know, have come up in our conversation. So he was really, really helpful in sending on some sources, both you and I know, kind of a project that you're working on.
Right. And we had a menage a trois on email.
We did. It was not quite as memorable, but the sandwich was good. And he sent along a couple really wonderful things, and probably get a chance to talk about them, but I definitely want to give a shout out to Finn and his book Wicked Portland that I think is coming out next month.
So, fantastic. I've got some stuff that I've compiled here as well. So
let's dive in.
We can either trade stories, or we could try and like string it through chronologically.
Let's go ahead and start, Brock. Let's see what you got.
Well, lay out a theme, Brock. What's the theme?
Let me start just with the first thing that I kind of organized all of my notes kind of chronologically. So basically, there's a guy named Eric Lundgren who has posted some stuff on Bike Portland. And it's a couple of years ago, but I remember reading this article about Governor Theodore Thurston Greer, who had a fantastic beard and rode 8 miles into Salem from his farm a wheel regularly. It's claimed he learned how to ride his bike wheel in only 2 lessons. So there's a clip here that that I believe the researcher found when he was putting the thing together. And the headline in the Oregonian, it's either the Oregonian or somewhere else, that just says, Greer has a wheel, which is a great headline.
Well, actually, the guy's name is Greer.
Greer, right? Which is also a fantastic name.
The clip you sent me, it says Gear.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, look at that. It says there's no R. Oh, yeah, it says Gear. Yeah, G-E-E-R.
Gear has a wheel. They're punning it
Governor
up.
Governor Gear. Yeah.
Puns perhaps created by poor spelling. I wonder if they caught that. Is this a typo that like has sat unknown for or unnoticed for like 100 years?
They may have noticed. 110. Not cared.
Seriously. The text here says, T.T. Greer of McClay, governor-elect of the state of Oregon, is in the city. After cultivating 12 acres of summer fallow on his farm Monday and pitching 2 or 3 tons of new mown hay, he then, apparently, made up his mind to shake the dust of the rural districts from his feet and come to the metropolis on a short visit. And I assume, it doesn't actually say that in the text that I have here, but I assume that means that, first of all, he plows and tears up 12 acres. He tosses a bunch of hay, several tons worth, and then he gets on a bicycle and rides to Salem.
To do his damn legislative work.
I guess, yeah, which it makes me – this guy is probably one of the coolest people I've ever heard about at this point.
Yeah.
If that is indeed the case.
I have a minimal background on the guy. Maybe you can back me up on this because I've never – taken a single.
I have not really delved much into Gear's career, to be honest.
The limited amount I know about him, I actually know that he was around in the time that, well, okay, so there's two things I would say, which is one, I know that he was a prominent farmer in the Shampooey region.
Right, right.
And which was really fertile and really profitable place to farm back in that time period.
It's also the closest hiker-biker camp spot now for Portlanders.
No shit, really.
Because it's a state park and there's a place you can camp there.
Oh, yeah, good camping.
Yeah. Great farmland, though.
And really fertile farmland. It actually was thought to be at one point kind of like the capital of Oregon because of how fertile it was. I also know that in his time period, biking was at least as trendy as it is today, which is a result of Oregon's traffic laws, which were a result not of the introduction of the automobile, but of the introduction of the bike, because it was so hard to understand how a bicyclist should interact with a carriage or a coach on the road that they needed to define the traffic laws. And they did such a good job defining that they narrowly altered them with the introduction of the automobile. And that came out of that time when, and I didn't know the guy's name specifically, but specifically I knew that like mayors and prominent politicians boasted about taking their bicycle in from the exurban communities into Portland into Salem to govern, and that was like a thing, like that the governor was on bike. And
that's really interesting. I know that when I was poking around, someone I think kind of used him as an unofficial spokesperson for a certain brand of bicycle. Either that or it was like the shop itself was saying, so we sold the bike that the governor has been riding around on, and don't you want to come in and get one too?
Well, you heard about that when Bud Clark was biking around Portland in the 80s.
Is that right?
It was sort of a callback to that era, that really progressive era in the late 19th century where Oregon was really ascendant and the governor was biking into work at the Capitol
building. Right.
And people would reference probably that same person.
Yeah. So I've made two mistakes already. It's Governor Gear, actually. G-E-E-R.
Oh, okay. Oh, really? Okay.
G-E-E-R. Yeah. Two E's. Huh. And he has a mustache in the portrait that we see here, not a beard. So
yeah, I like to think, though, that he was most likely shaved before that photo.
I would imagine,
His kick-ass beard was taken away.
Before he had to sit in front of the camera for like 15 minutes while the plates firmed up. As I understand, Gear is most notable for making an enormous ride from Salem to, I believe, what is now Shampooey State Park. But May of 1900, Gear was tasked with locating the site of the 1843 meeting that established the provisional government of the Oregon Territory. So he's going to say this is where all that stuff actually happened. Kind of like the famed Council Crest here in Portland. There's the story of all the is it ecumenical ministers who are all gathered up there by riding a trolley or a cart or something like that up together. Similarly, the founding fathers of Oregon Territory, before it was actually a state, all got together at Shampooey. And the governor was going to recreate this site and ride out and see it. So he actually did this. May 1st, bicycled through French Prairie to meet the only surviving member of the meeting, which was F.X. Mathieu.
Yeah. French Canadian.
And the thing that I love about the French Canadians that I've read is that, you know, they were really pissed about the vote because there was a feeling that they were going to be taxed for each of the windows in their homes.
Is that right?
You know, and they're fundamentally opposed to this taxation, you know, and so somebody had to calm them down and say, no, the Americans will not tax you for each window you have. You know, that was going to cut the deal for them. You know,
That's fantastic.
If I can give a little plug to our June 1st, Big Fucking Bigfoots in Oregon podcast that's coming out on Kick-Ass Oregon History, orhistory.com. This little bit of a spoiler for your audience only. Okay. I haven't revealed this anywhere else.
So this
Shampooey State Park is featured in some manner in it. And two, the individual in Shampooey State Park is on a bicycle. And it was not planned for Sprocket Podcast.
Hey, now this is a happy accident right
this
here.
This is all about Gear. So, you know.
I hope I'm not screwing over your thing, but I know where this spot is. It's I filmed there.
Oh, okay. You get around,
movie
sir.
That keeps coming up, McMillan. I didn't come here to plug my movie. If you go to one of our filming locations, the Robert Newell House, and they have a tea house, which used to be a barn, and you look out that window, there's a big field, and that actually, in that field, was where they held the meeting that consecrated the state of Oregon.
Nice.
And let me tell you, what you say in terms of miles, that's an intense ride down to Salem.
Oh, yeah. Like, yeah,
that's
from Salem.
A real ride. People still do that.
Mm-hmm.
And when we were filming, you know, we'd be shooting on one side people in 19th century costume, and then behind us would be bike riders.
Yeah.
And they were popular with motorcyclists and bicyclists.
Yeah.
Would do that ride on the weekends every day. So that's still a thing.
If I'm not mistaken, there's a scenic bikeway that was established. Uh-huh. It was, I believe, the first one in Oregon where they had an actual signed route that people would be able to follow on bicycles through these rural country roads and through like cute little places like Brownsville near Eugene. Oh, but I believe that's one of the ending points or starting points is at Champoy State Park. And that takes you right down through Salem. So, it's something that people still do today.
Yeah, and it's just a place that I think every Oregonian should go just at some point. Just right. Flat out. Just
it's fun. Real nice down there. Yeah. Political differences aside, I worked very closely to make the film with the Daughters of the American Revolution,
who have
a number of museums in that area.
Okay.
They're super cool. It's really cheap to go see those old houses built in the 1830s, 1840s.
Yeah. With lots of windows.
With a ton of glass windows.
Untaxed windows. Yeah. And so this was also, if I understand correctly, Aurora was the first incorporated city in Oregon. Is that, can anybody validate this?
I can attest to that.
I'm not sure if that's the case.
I'm not doubting you, Brock.
Yeah, but I've heard that, if not the first, at least one of the first. It was a utopian community,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, and, absolutely.
And
yeah.
That's not too far away from Champoy.
Mm-hmm. It's in that area. I guess it depends what you call it, incorporated. It certainly seems like Astoria was incorporated probably 30, 40 years before that in terms of...
Right.
I mean,
being
it was
a place
a city
where people lived and did stuff.
Yeah. Place. Yeah.
Yeah.
But...
Astoria, also the Astoria was a location of the famous 1903 plague, which you can learn more about if you go to orhistory.com.
That's right.
Which I've read
that
blog entry, and that's fascinating stuff.
Good. I'm glad everybody enjoyed that.
I'll let you all work that out for yourselves.
I'm glad that Mr. Lovecraft isn't rolling over in his grave. The buggering we did to his story.
So. Indeed. We were talking a little bit about the... bicycles becoming a kind of a new mode of transport and people figuring out how they worked on the roads and how they interacted. And there's actually a guy here, the same fellow, Eric Lundgren, wrote a separate article about a fellow from Portland in the turn of that century, late 1800s, early 1900s, Bamer Pegg, I think is how you'd say his name. But he was a weatherman and a lawyer around the turn of the century, and he was a fan and proponent of separate bicycle paths. He spoke highly of Columbia Boulevard and Vancouver Avenue, which if you've been there today is no park. There's no such thing as a park anywhere near that. But at the turn of that century, it was actually, what do they call it? Cherry Grove. It was a popular destination for bicyclists, or they were sometimes known as wheelmen. So anyways, they would make their way down there, and this led to...
Cherry Park, sorry to interrupt you,
is
still known as a neighborhood. It's Cherry Park Elementary.
Okay, that's right, and that's just kind of up the hill from Columbia there. Yeah, but Columbia is a really big industrial part of the city now. It's it's all big rigs and lots of smog and that sort of thing. The Columbia Slough is nearby, which is...
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. That would have been gorgeous.
Yeah, definitely. So if you can imagine that, instead of having all the big industrial buildings that are there now, if you can imagine cherry trees growing and blossoming and flowering, and these wonderful paths of freshly laid macadam that wheelmen would wheel down and take their bicycle ride from Portland to Vancouver or to the river for a picnic, that sort of thing. People were just gloriously agog at the idea that you could get onto this machine and whiz somewhere else and suddenly be in this beautiful place. So, those things were great. Let's see. Peg was a bike advocate and legal advocate. And let's see, he actually made his debut in 1899. There's a clipping here, a reporter, possibly from the Oregonian. I'm not quite sure, but sources available on request. Weather Prophet Pegg made his debut as attorney in the municipal court yesterday afternoon as assistant prosecutor in the case of the City of Portland versus H. Bush, accused of driving his horse and buggy across the Vancouver bicycle path. Mr. Bush was not present, but his attorney was on hand to watch the corners and see that the prosecution did not have things all its own way. Deputy Sheriff Albert Gee testified that he had arrested Bush in the act of driving over the path to avoid a puddle near the end of Williams Avenue Plank Road. So, Peg was the lawyer kind of, he was the first one kind of standing up for the rights of cyclists here in Portland to make sure that, that people were not driving where they ought not to drive. And that's something that's still happening from time to time. You know, it's more moved to the streets with bicycle lanes and the new bike boxes. But that's something that apparently has been happening for a long, long time.
Sure.
Plank roads. You guys know anything about those?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You know, a lot of people refer to this as Stump Town. I like to look back at those pictures, and it looks like Mud Town to me. Fields and fields of mud in the street, and the plank road was absolutely something that could be utilized to easily move commerce, goods, people throughout these muddy areas without bogging down in them. And a couple of great ones, such as the Great Plank Road,
right?
Which the marker is down by the art museum and is most likely what goes out 26.
Is that right?
Yeah. They would take these big 4x4s or whatever they had at the time, and they would soak them in tar, and they would lay them in the road. And the idea was they would sit in the road until liquefaction, erosion would absorb them into it.
Okay.
And then if it was appropriate, they would dig them back up. If they were salvageable, they would reorganize them and lay them back down. To this day, you can, along Highway 26, so Powell Boulevard and further out, if you look where the road deviates from where it used to deviate, and you dig down a few feet, they have layers of those boards.
So you'll still find these planks just sitting around the city. Mm-hmm.
They look kind of like railroad ties.
Interesting.
And sometimes they would sink so far down that they didn't bother to salvage them.
Mm-hmm. They just lay
more plank on top. They put down a layer of sand and then a layer of plank on top of it. And so out in like kind of near Boring and stuff, you can actually, they will be doing road project and dig up these tar encrusted planks from 1860s or something.
Yeah. That's fascinating.
Yeah, wow. It's pretty cool.
That's amazing. And it really shows that, sometimes you just pave over whatever is there. Things really haven't changed all that much in 100 absolutely. Years.
In 2009, they discovered streetcar tracks under Ankeny Boulevard.
Yeah. Under Ankeny?
Yeah.
You think they would have found those earlier? I guess it's paving over again.
I'm sure some guys like you knew they were there, when they tore up the street, they were surprised to find that the tracks had not been demolished, even though they knew a streetcar ran there at one point, but just merely paved over.
Right. Yeah. Well, asphalt fixes many things, I guess, apparently.
Good preservation agent.
Yeah. I'm just amazed at the idea that this was something that's been happening, everything old being new again, you know. Many people, I think just a couple weeks ago, Rob Sadowski, who's going to be on the show next week, was being interviewed by Lars Larson, who is our local conservative blowhard on the AM station, and they were talking about the merits from Sadowski's perspective and the problems from Larson's perspective of bicyclists being on the roads and all this stuff. And I just love the idea that back in the turn of the century, like 1900, you would have like these new MacAdam paths being constructed for cyclists, and all the people who are used to driving their carts on plank roads might be saying, "Well, what about us? Right. When do we get our new MacAdam roads for our carts?" That sort of thing.
Well, and you work on a fundamental idea that the basic mode of transportation was like, I don't know, was the horse and cart prior to the construction of the law. Mm-hmm. And so that men came out with horse and cart, and you created a set of laws to accommodate pedestrians and bicyclists and mass transit. Nothing could be further from the truth. They came simultaneously. The construction of Portland was predicated on the notion of light rail transit, of horse-drawn trolley transit, of bicyclists, people on foot. It all was there, and it all came together simultaneously. And that really the motivating engine, as someone who does not really bike, the motivating engine was the invention of the bicycle. And it preceded the notion of cars really being an urban instrument.
Right.
And so when someone goes on to a mass media and talks about like, well, the basic framing of transit law orients historically around the car, they're just lying.
Yeah. Like this is not the case.
They're fundamentally making something up.
Right.
Whatever you believe, whatever the best way forward is, if you state that, you're just lying. You're just making shit. In the state of Oregon, you're literally lying.
That's good to know.
We wrote our transit laws around bicycles because bicyclists and horses and horse-drawn transportation were having trouble getting along.
Right, right.
That's why we have transit laws in Oregon.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel about going up against Lars on that? Would you?
I I take him to task on the facts. I'd win hands down. He'd just yell at me.
Yeah, well, that's kind of how it works. Or laugh.
Yeah, I mean, yeah,
those are his two responses.
It'd be like if I tried to argue with him about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. He'd right. just scream at me till I couldn't think anymore.
And right, right.
Then he'd declare himself a winner.
mean, technology is wonderfully useful, I guess, in that way. Ground people out.
But dude is wrong.
Right, right.
He can say anything he wants. He's just factually wrong.
Another quote from the article that I was reading here is the Oregonian editorializing on self-policing among bicyclists, reporting on this case of Mr. H. Bush. H. Bush was found guilty of driving on the Vancouver bicycle path by Judge Hennessy on Wednesday. So far, so good. The United Women's Association, who pushed the prosecution of the offender, have acted entirely within their legal rights in their efforts to protect the paths. Now let them show equal zeal and energy in protecting the public by making complaint against certain notorious scorchers who use 6th Street, Morrison Street, and other business thoroughfares as a racetrack on which to display their antics.
I love the scorchers.
That's really familiar.
Which actually is not too different from the tone the Oregonian takes now, I think.
Yeah, right?
So, yeah. Although it seems they were slightly more positive on bicycles 100 years ago than they are today. But, you know, that
slightly
things change, but not too much.
A little.
Sheldon Brown, a famous bicycle guy. Either of you guys know who Sheldon Brown was? He also had a fantastic beard. That's how you know who to trust in this world.
I got a bike and a beard.
Sheldon Brown was from the Boston, Massachusetts area, and he was largely known as the guru about everything bicycles. He's still got a website online. He passed away a couple of years ago, but he's got a website online that basically tells you how to do most of the things you need to do on your bicycle and kind of how to approach those things yourself. Sheldon Brown, on his online dictionary, defines scorcher as a fast, reckless cyclist who scares horses and old folks. This term was current in the late 19th century. So, thank you, Sheldon Brown.
Yeah.
But, yeah. there's Liverpool Liz came up in our discussion, Stuck, and I want to make sure we get to that because I feel like you might have maybe more insight into that than I do. I gave some cursory readings, but mostly what I figured out is that she lived in Portland, she rode a bicycle, and she tried to start a racetrack with a tavern in the middle.
She did. Well, the point that I really like about Liverpool Liz before that is she was in the North End, you know, which is kind of the area, the time of where all the really bad stuff happened.
Okay.
And
This is the north end of Portland?
The north end of Portland, absolutely.
So what
we call today Chinatown, today's Chinatown, Old Town area.
Gotcha.
And she ran a bordello. Well, she ran a saloon or a tavern. It was a drinking establishment.
On the books.
There were girls there, absolutely. And Liz was, you know, picking up in the bike craze that was going on at the time, and she decided that she would make this ring, you know, or this bike track, essentially, for races to take place among her ladies with a saloon in the middle.
There
so people could just go ahead and buy drinks. And, you know, the kind of the demise of some of the trends of bicycling at the time were in some ways attributed in the sources that I've read to Liverpool Liz and her ladies riding around in these rather garish outfits, honking their horns to solicit people to buy bikes that Liz was also stocking and selling.
It's so sexual.
It was incredibly sexual. And these women were riding around and
doesn't
in these really
like a bad business.
Not at all.
Today,
you know, these,
I mean.
these colorful outfits, but the more sophisticated women of Portland who were being, you know, really starting to get into bicycles were kind of turned off a little bit by that. It was a little too garish for them at that point.
Right. So if you ride a bicycle, you're a whore.
A little
basically.
Bit. Yeah.
Well,
before it was
okay,
but
certainly a lot of talk at the time of the sexual nature of the bicycle seat.
I actually have a quote about that.
Was an issue.
If I can find it here. Where is it? Yes. there's an author that wrote a book about bicycling called Wheels of Change, How Women Rode the Bicycle to Freedom. And one of her quotes here, Jonathan Moss from Bike Portland covered this some time back. It in part said that it was scandalous and led to many romantic encounters, friendships, and romances. It was basically being able to go out and entertain your gentleman caller wherever you wanted to, as opposed to having to wait at home where your family might object or might say.
I think it wouldn't be on that in so much as... I apologize for being graphic. There's a shape to a bicycle seat.
Yes, there is.
Which people might recognize as having a commonality with portions of the male anatomy.
It's somewhat phallic, yes.
And you have to interact with it with a very personal part of your body.
That's quite true.
So, and that was, you know, to us, that's nothing. That's just a personal thing. That's just a coincidence. I think in the 19th century, in the Victorian era, in the Edwardian era, that irony, well, it wasn't an irony. It was a specific fact of life that freaked them out.
Right, mm-hmm. right. And here it is. It led to Morro police speaking out against the bicycle as the devil's advance agent. Doctors of the day even worried that some women only liked to ride bikes because the seats were a means of gratifying unholy and bestial desires.
Hmm.
Also known as apparently orgasm is what they're saying here.
But again,
I don't know. They might be full of shit.
It's unfortunate that you have this kind of like this literally a vehicle of liberation, you know, available to women, and they're allowed to come out of their homes. They're allowed to kind of expand their community into this much larger radius, and then just boom, this clamp down upon them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in Finn's book that I was referencing earlier, he talks a little bit about in the 1880s, the high wheel, in my air quotes here, the ordinary bicycles, as they were called, were difficult for women to ride at the time because their skirts could get caught in that really high wheel.
Oh, sure, yeah.
But then the bicycle that we refer to, well, that we, the basic design that we know to know today, was called the safety bicycle.
Yes.
Exactly. Mm. Allowed these women, such as Liverpool Liz's ladies, to drive around and not have to be concerned about that skirt getting in there and really tearing things up. So again, it was, I look at that as another example of liberation that the bicycle brought to these women in the 1890s. And just wasn't too cool with some fellas in the area.
Yeah, well, it does seem as though maybe that's the sort of trend that you could imagine happening around bicycling today, because I see the bicycle as something that really levels the playing field. For one thing, when you're on a bicycle, you're interacting with other people on the road. So if you're a person, say, of status or class who is used to traveling alone, traveling in your own car, perhaps being driven or chauffeured, being out in the public on your own vehicle and not having someone driving you around, that's immediately a threatening sort of thing. And the idea that people groups who possibly are less advantaged than white male Americans, you know, also being able to get places in the same way, being able to go to and fro, to be able to afford transportation that's reliable, that you can keep around. That's the sort of thing that kind of shakes feathers. People get nervous when something starts to upend what has become a social convention. So yeah, it seems I'm fascinated by that. Just the fact that it's something that it's happened before. It may happen again. So
So, well, there's something so almost communist, so egalitarian about the idea that we're all going to get together. We're all going to go to where we work, and it's going to be physical activity, physical labor, and you can't really wear a tuxedo while you bike.
You can, but it's less comfortable.
Yeah, right. You know, you're all going to have to wear basically the same thing and then change later, and then you're all going to have to sweat together,
right?
Regardless of your standing, regardless of what job you're going to, if you're going to work in a high rise, whether you're going to work at a construction site, you're all going to be sweating together and on the road together. There's something I think that's genuinely egalitarian about that. That's pretty cool, and I could see people being threatened by that, whether that's threats of race or threats of class or threats of gender, right? And sex. We want to keep people, the way we move around, we want to keep people separate. We want to find ways to define each other.
Right.
And if you take the automobile and automobile culture out of it and go back to the 19th century, well, coaches are a great thing. If someone's trotting down the road on their horse or their mule, it's pretty clear what class status they are. If someone's got a nice coach and a driver, well, then that makes their status very clear. But a bike's kind of a bike. Even a nice bike versus a crappy bike is not as clear a definition as that.
Right. The subtleties are smaller. Yeah. And from a distance, everyone looks like, you know, you're on a safety bicycle. There you are. Two wheels, a frame.
Yeah. And you're going. Yeah. And everyone's in the same lane. So
exactly.
Yeah. And I think that's relevant today. Personally, I mean, that's just an opinion, but I think that this idea that we're all going to just get in there and be working, kind of doing like a physical labor, almost like pounding nails or building things, you know, together. Like we're all going to just go and sweat our way into work that threatens a kind of a hierarchy that
it really does. Yeah.
It's tough. It's tough for people to accept.
Yeah. Well, there's a great thing too about transit. And I was thinking about the Humanity on Wheels event, Doug, somebody at the open mic shared a story about, There was a guy on a bus who was spewing homophobic epithets, just saying, you know, like you know, you're a terrible person, and using a bunch of words that were unpleasant and all this, and the bus driver standing up and saying, you know what, when you're on the bus, you don't get to treat people that way, and ejecting the rider for causing the disturbance. And I love the fact that transit also kind of works as a great equalizer, because when you get on the bus, I mean, you've got a choice in what you wear, I guess, and some people wear a tuxedo on the bus, some people don't, but you know, the bus is a yeah. fantastic equalizing force.
We all paid fair.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. Yes, we do. Exactly. Fair is fair, yeah. as they say. So, anyways.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I love riding the bus. I commute back and forth to work every day.
Every fucking day.
Every fucking day.
As you
I
are
have
quoted,
done so.
Yes.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, the thing that really interests me, too, you know, and we can talk about different levels of classism, but if you notice, there's definitely bus people. And then there's Max people.
That you know, in itself, and then there's tram people.
There's tram people, you know. And every once in a while, it's a nice day. I can catch the yellow line because I live up in North Portland. And, you know, I can catch the 44 or the 4 and kind of get to the same area. The bus allows me a shorter walk, which is nice on a rainy day. Uh-huh. But it's a nice sunny day. I'll just, you know, I get onto that yellow line and I get off by New Seasons. And it's a bit more of a walk to my house, but I enjoy it. But I definitely feel like a tourist. When I get onto the Max, yeah. you know, it's not a bus. I don't know what it is.
I don't think it's a specific comment on rail. It's a comment on the way we build transit in the city, and we've built our rail system around a certain kind of an ease that appeals to a certain kind of a voter. I think, I don't know, and that makes it a very palatable solution for people who are in these strategic areas. It's mm-hmm. not everybody. I mean, come on, not everybody on the yellow line is upper class. It's
sure.
just that a higher percentage of them fit into a better sort of maybe more East Coast definition of what you maybe think of as a bridge and tunnel type.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you take a 4 bus down from North Portland or out from East Portland like I do,
yeah.
you ride the
yeah.
same bus,
mm-hmm.
they're going to be people who just don't have a choice.
Yeah.
They take their car if they could. They're not doing it because they think it's yeah. green.
Right.
That's what they have to do every day.
Just because it exists.
Yeah. yeah.
And that's how it works.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. You take the 4 in from where I live, and you're going to be listening to, if you don't have your iPhone in like I do, you're going to be listening to 3 to 4 languages at a single go.
Right.
If not mm-hmm. more. That's just who has to take the bus.
Mm-hmm.
And if a long division there were... more businesses and then more upper class citizenry, I would be certain that there would be a train line to supplement that.
Right.
And that those people would not be served by that bus. That's how we build transit. I mean, that's why we just had a big throwdown about a streetcar line to Lake Oswego, which is so divisive, not to get political,
right.
but it gets so divisive in that, like, there should be rail transit to the communities surrounding Portland.
Especially
I think that. Yeah,
yeah. The ones that feed business. But it's the same sort of thing that is right now kind of in the spotlight for the Green Line, which goes from Portland, downtown Portland, to Clackamas County. And Clackamas is complaining that the Green Line is bringing gang activity to Clackamas County. And there was a similar concern that I think maybe that people who are transient or looking for another place, another bridge to sleep under, might be moving down to Lake Oswego. And anyone who lives near here knows that Oswegans are not down with that. But then they also know, if you've looked at, what is it, ancient Portland history?
Yes.
You'll know that there's nothing a Greshamite likes better than a good barbecued Oswegan. So maybe they're right to fear it.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Brock, for finding the one thing I agree with Greshamites on.
Tasty, man. Tasty.
Delicious. So fatty and tender.
Oh, well, Doug, do you have anything else that you really wanted to underscore or highlight? I don't want to shut you out, but we probably should wrap up the episode at some point soon.
Oh, I think if folks are interested in this a bit more, you should look a little bit into a fellow named Fred Merrill.
That's right. And you sent me some stuff on him.
Yeah. And actually, this had come from Finn again as well. Fred Merrill was kind of a big bike dealer in Portland in the 1880s and 1890s. He actually came to Portland because he was quite a fancy trick rider, and he'd heard that there was this fellow named Charles Booth who was claiming that he was the best trick rider in the nation. So Fred came up here from San Francisco on the Columbia steamer, and
performed an act and called out Booth directly there and said, hey, let's go toe-to-toe. You and I are going to battle this out. And we're going to see who's the best bicyclist here in town. Booth said, you bet. Next day, he fucking skedaddled and got out of here. So Merrill stuck around for quite a while. And he claimed that he made $1.5 million selling bikes in Portland.
That's right. Yeah. It was one of the most popular shops. It was
absolutely
hopping. Yeah.
You know, and I think he sold Ramblers. Is that right?
Possibly. Yeah. Was that in the article here?
You know, the other nice thing that he said is he spent all that money in Portland. He died broke is what it sounded like to me. But it's a really good one. There's a series that was in the Oregonian, looks like March 8th, 1936. And they're full page articles. And it looks like they went on for about 3 weeks. And I really enjoyed reading about Mr. Merrill and some of the things that he talked about and some of the things that, you know, he says that he brought here.
Now, so we're clear, this is different from the Merrill bike manufacturer.
He was not a manufacturer, exactly. Okay. He was a retailer.
They do make Merrill bikes.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So he did talk about, there was an event, and it's really small print, so I got to lift up my glasses here. There was at Multnomah Field that they brought in, Joe Cook was the name of a man that raised horses, and he brought in 16 fast steppers, and Merrill raced them.
Yeah.
And he raced these steppers, I think it was over 8 days. It was a total of 48 hours. No, it was 6 days of 8 hours each. And so they would rotate these horses in and out every half hour. And Merrill ended up beating him over the 48 hours. And he says he doesn't think there was a person alive in Portland that didn't come at some point to watch what was going on
at
the Timber Stadium now.
Uh-huh,
so yeah, exactly. That was a neat little slice out of there, too, that I got.
That's pretty cool.
So, yeah, I'd definitely encourage people to look a bit into him. And I don't know if he's been written about too much more in too many of the Portland histories that I've seen and kind of the more accessible stuff.
It's pretty cool. I mean, I think of myself as an enthusiast and never heard about him. That's pretty cool.
It's a neat. And again, I want to thank Finn John for forwarding this on. So
definitely. Yeah. Thank you, Finn.
Yeah, that was good.
That's fantastic. Also, one of my favorite parts of this, when I first saw it, was this little ad down here in the corner. It has nothing to do with bicycling at all. But there's a lady in lingerie kind of leaning seductively and saying, oh, rheumatic pains. And apparently it's an ad for Ben Gay. Just for, you know, helping your muscles feel better. But it just goes to show that sex has been used to sell things for a long, long time.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, maybe I'll try and get that up again. I think I tweeted that when I saw it because I thought it was funny.
Oh, the days when you could use rheumatic pain to sell Ben Gay. Sex and rheumatic pain are not things we associate today.
Right.
The other thing that I really liked about Merrill's story is just kind of a side note. I mean, there was the ad in there, but the other thing that really popped out on me is, you know, again, he got onto the steamer Columbia from San Francisco to come up to Portland to basically battle Charles Booth. And who was on board but a company, you know, a theatric company called the Stockton Humpty Dumpty Extravaganza Company. And they found out that Merrill was quite the bicyclist. So they said, hey, man, you want to do intermissions for us? And he's like, yeah, you know, he's stuck on this fucking steamer, right? I mean, right now, yeah, well, I might as well. I mean, I got to battle this fucking guy, but sure, you know, job's a job.
He turned into a vaudeville trick.
Exactly. That's the Humpty Dumpty Extravaganza Company.
That's fantastic. And they're just like, hey, do a trick.
Exactly. Oh, you don't have a monkey? You got a bike? That's cool.
Well, that's like, not to drag your poor podcast out, but that, you know, I've heard stories of people coming over from East India and being, you know, like, they're just here. They're trying to work. And it turns out, actually, you could do something like, say, belly dance in a vaudeville troupe. And they would just get signed on and be traveling to lumber towns doing belly dancing or sword swallowing or some random thing. And like that random people would show up and be sucked into these traveling troops.
That's fantastic.
Just because it was something different, like riding a bike.
Yeah, definitely.
We need some more of that. We really do.
Yeah. Pedalpalooza coming up in 2 weeks or something like that. Yeah.
There we go.
Just lastly, before we sign off on this, Jonathan Moss on a blog post some time back came up with, there's a photograph of a man riding a fixed gear bike in the 1890s. This is, I believe, N.C. Kaufman is the name. He also has a mustache. It's popular. It's been popular for a long time. And this is not in Portland, but it was just an old photograph that had been discovered. And he compares that with Ben Ficklin is pictured here, who is doing almost the same fix gear trick 100 years later in Portland. Do you guys both see that?
I can. Looks like is he in front of the Hawthorne there?
Yeah, he is Hawthorne actually. I think he's down on the Esplanade. Yeah,
yeah. He's right in front of the restaurant there.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. So anyways, it's been around for a long time. Everything old is new again. So that's been fun. Well, hey, thank you again, Doug, for coming in. We're going to hit our mailbag here real quick and get some input from some folks.
Can I tell folks a real quick show that I've got coming up? June 19th, Tuesday, we're down at the Jack London Bar. We've got our big fucking Bigfoots in Oregon show where we're going to talk about the historical incidents of the phenomena of Bigfoot. And the orhistory.com investigative team Sasquatch, we went out into the wilds of Oregon in our own quest to find Bigfoot. We were live tweeting about it, which was a lot of fun. We were sponsored by Maryhill Winery in addition to Jack London Bar, so things got pretty fucking ugly pretty quick. When you're sponsored by a winery, they don't give you money. You know, they give you wine, which is fucking awesome at like 2 p.m. and then things go bad. But anyways, we're going to talk about what we found. We're going to have some zoologists and biologists down there as well. Damn. It's our first anniversary of Kick-Ass Oregon History down at the Jack London Bar, so we're going to have cake.
Yeah, this is a live event that happens monthly, right?
This will be a live
monthly,
event
right?
monthly, the third Tuesday of every month down there. We talk about some element of Oregon's past, interesting stuff.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'd like to invite folks to come on down if they get an opportunity.
Yeah, please do. Please do.
It'll be a good time.
And a matter of fact, I've only been to Humanity on Wheels so far, but having been there, number one, I never knew that the Rialto Pool Room had something underneath it. Mm-hmm. It's a fantastic venue, fantastic place. Yeah. And then I never knew that you could just hang out there and hear about you know, a historical subject being rambled about in a fantastic educational way with a little bit of culture thrown in there. It's very much your own sort of thing. So
Terry down at the Jack London Bar has just been doing wonderful things for the historical and just kind of the geekery community here in town. So it's fantastic. The Jack London Bar is not to be missed.
Thank you, Terry.
Yeah.
So anyways, please do catch that. And with that, was there anything else we should make sure say again? Oregon History.
Orhistory.com. Yeah. And Kick-Ass Oregon History is the name of the podcast. You can search that. We're on the iTunes. They haven't shut us down yet.
Good.
And I like to keep it like that, you know. But please check us out. And
fantastic. Well, with that.
You've got mail.
All right. We've got just a couple notes here. There was something anonymous. Someone sent this to the sprocketpodcast at gmail.com, which is exactly how you can contact us if you'd like to. And it was just simply Gutter Party. Number one, number two. Gutter Party number one is already done. I think that's what they were promoting, but they did not get that to me in time, or perhaps I forgot to put it on in time. Basically, I think they are. Oh, and I see the Gutter Party for Memorial Day was canceled. So, anyway, this someone sent me an email about gutter parties. It's cleaning the roads, basically, going out with a broom and a dustpan and pulling stuff off of the roads that you like to ride on.
Now I feel bad that I laugh so hard.
No, it's wonderfully charitable. It is kind of clandestine. It's hard to understand who these people are. They didn't tell me. So anyways, gutterparty.com. You go to that and apparently you can find out about the ones that are coming up later on.
I was picturing myself drunk on jungle juice, laying in a gutter at 2 p.m.
That's a different kind of
not,
gutter
not
party.
Cleaning the streets like a noble citizen.
You know, the sad thing is we've all been there, right?
Yeah.
Right.
One side or the other. Carl from California says, hey guys, just bumped into this on the interwebs on the Facebook. An extra cycle sidecar. Imagine touring with this rig. And this was really, really cool. You guys familiar with the extra cycle bicycle?
Oh, yeah.
It's the long tail design, which extends the frame by several feet, giving you more cargo capacity so you can hold groceries or kids or whatever else that you want to on the back of this long, long bike. This is a side view here.
Cool.
Of basically, it's a sidecar that will fold down so you can store it folded on the bike when you're not using it. But then when you are using it, you fold down and it gives you a platform out to the right side of your bicycle, which you can use to store whatever it is that you're going to carry on there.
That looks incredible.
Which
really
I think
looks great.
Is a fantastic idea. Blaine from BC says, hey, fellas, thanks for the retweets for my blog. I appreciate it. And his blog is, I'm blanking on it. The Cynical Cyclist, and I'll have a link on the website to that. But he says, sent you a donation for all your hard work. Thank you, Blaine. Summer can't get here fast enough. I am preparing for my first solo trip, a 4-day trip on northern Vancouver Island later in August. I assume that means a bicycle trip. If any Sprocket listeners are vacationing on Vancouver Island this summer, I would love to hear from you. Contact me through my blog, The Cynical Cyclist. Have a great summer and find adventure. So if you are, in fact, up on Vancouver Island this summer, make sure you get in touch with Blaine. I still want to meet this guy in person because he seems like an awesome guy. Dan in Minnesota, in response to our talk about the disaster relief trials sponsored by Transportland. And have you guys heard about this? The disaster relief trials is basically an emergency situation kind of enacted using cargo bikes as response vehicles. So say the roads are so fucked by an earthquake, I believe is what they're using in this scenario, that you can't drive and you can't take things from one place to another. Cargo bikes are a great alternative. So they're going to have folks from all over riding their cargo bikes of choice to see how fast they can take disaster relief supplies from one place to another. So like a tank of propane and a bunch of first aid supplies and whatever else it was that you would need. It's pretty cool. So it's
pretty cool.
Yeah. Dan says, when I worked in public health, I had asked the EMS program if they would consider getting on bicycles. Getting them on bicycles to respond, a first responder situation would make it quicker and easier. And there's actually some folks, we talked about this in a show a long time back, some folks who are doing that. And I don't remember where they were, somewhere in the northeast of the United States of America. So I'll have to find out what that was and post some information about that.
You should get these guys in touch with the Bathtub Bandits.
What's this?
The Bathtub Bandits have, since my grandfather's generation, been staging races across the Willamette, usually around the Ross Island Bridge. Basic idea is you get into a homemade boat, usually made out of a clawfoot bathtub that's been gummed up, and you try to row that fucker across the Willamette River. The irony is that at some point, somewhere, they realize that actually if there was, say, an earthquake, specifically an earthquake, mm-hmm. and the bridges didn't work, these drunken businessmen would be the guys who would be most equipped to actually take stuff across the river.
Right.
So as of 2003, which is the last time I talked to the Bathtub Bandits, they were sort of like – they were doing these races where they would try to load their homemade canoes with as much cargo as they could and then race as much like cargo, which I think was cement blocks.
There you go.
Across the river.
Yeah.
Wow.
If you got these guys to work with the Bathtub Bandits, yeah. you'd be
– Yeah, no kidding. The propane and ham radio is just in the bottom of the clawfoot tub.
Going back and forth.
That's fantastic. Wow. And then lastly, we've got donations from Blaine and donations from Johnny K. So thanks to both of you. You guys are helping underwrite the cost of beer, of wine, and of hosting for podcasts. So thanks,
folks. Excellent beer this evening
tonight. Yeah.
By the way, we didn't even talk about that. What, we were drinking the Widmer Brothers, which is a Portland beer.
Absolutely.
I figured I should do that for the Oregon History episode. This is the W12 Dark Saison. And I don't know too much about it, but I like it. It tastes
good. Wonderful. The malts were lovely. Yeah. Absolutely lovely.
Yeah, yeah. Widmer Brothers has also had some fantastic radio commercials over their history here in Portland. Upcoming shows, June 3rd, next week, Rob Sadowski from the Bicycle Transportation Alliance. We're going to talk to him about his time in Washington, D.C. at the National Bicycle Summit.
Cool.
And also about his encounter with Lars Larson. June 10th.
Make it sound like a UFO or something. I mean, he's a dude a lot here in town, right?
I've heard him described as a sack of flour with beady eyes. I'm not sure if that's any closer to the truth or not. I can't attest to that. June 10th, our Rockers chat with the Pathless Pedal. We taped that more than a month ago now, and you guys are finally going to be able to get to hear it in anticipation of their concurring with the disaster relief trials. They also are sponsoring a zombie ride, so that's happening.
Awesome. I thought it was ride bicycles to avoid zombies, not be chased by fucking zombies on bicycles.
It's a great. You can choose either one.
That
you can
come, so cool,
you can
man.
Come as a zombie on a bike. You can come as someone fleeing zombies. Yeah, so, yeah,
cool.
And I think that will all surround the those who are actually participating in a real life scenario. So, it all happens at Velo Cult, which is going to be great. That happens on June 17th, and after that. I think we're still ironing out the date for this. It's not going to be the actual 17th. It may be the day two after, but we're going to sit down with the guys from Transportland who love cargo bikes and are effusive about them. We're going to talk to them and see what they have to say. And then after that, I leave on tour, on my bike tour with my wife for a couple of months, and you're going to have a pre-taped interview on the 24th with Stacy from A Simple Six. That's six folks. They're a family of... four kids between like 4 and 12, something like that. And they all ride bikes in one of the Carolinas. Oh, I'm embarrassed now. I can't remember. Anyways, the East Coast, a place where people do not ride bikes. So they're holding it out, holding it down out there. So we're proud of them. So that's what's coming up. This is the end. Last thoughts, folks, before we close out the show?
I got nothing.
Oh, okay, that's fine.
I got this. I'm super stoked that the Sprocket has introduced me to Oregon history.
Right on.
That's a great website and a great podcast, and I didn't know about it before the last time I was on this podcast, and it's awesome. I check it regularly.
And I'm just glad that we can come together with history and bikes and buses and everything that is just kind of neat that's going on here in this town, in this state, and broadcast across the nation. It's fucking awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you both for being here.
You bet.
We will close out the show at this point. Where did I put that? Oh, can I have that piece of copy? Because I don't have that stuff memorized at all. Thank you.
I could misread it for you.
I suppose it's true. You could.
Could I be the second guest misreader?
Find us on the internet at thesprocketpodcast.com. Please send us our email. Our email address is thesprocketpodcast@gmail.com. We'd love to know what you want us to talk about, what you want us to drink, and who you want us to talk to. We've got a voicemail line. It's 503-847-9774. You can also text us if you'd like. Ryan J. Lane gives us our theme music. He's on the internet at myspace.com. And that's not right. He's at bandcamp.com. It's ryanjlane.bandcamp.com. And Hurtbird for our headline sounder at hurtbirdmusic.com. Thanks, folks. Stay historic and kick ass.
This is my level here. So right, what do you think of that? Does that look good?
I think it looks great. It's far lower than the level you had at the Jack London
Bar. Yeah.
But that was a rock and roll.
Yeah, that was a rock and roll event. Exactly. And a tweet here and there. So. I do most of my recording at 5 in the morning.
Yeah, right.
You know, when it's just totally quiet.
Right, when you don't have to worry about anything happening.
Yeah.
You also have fantastic sleeves. I have not seen those yet. That's
usually wearing a suit kind of thing. That's part of my persona. You know, it's like it's the whole historian thing. Right. So.
Just for the tape.
How family friendly does the content section need to be?
You know, it doesn't have to be family friendly at all.
Okay, no. That's good. Because even though I have two children, I hate children.
Is that so?
No, it's
okay.
Not.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought it'd be good tape.
So, yeah. So in that case, I would say
children are our future.
Yes, they are.
Exactly.